Vitakka and vijara are two Pali words that mean thinking. They're classified as verbal fabrication. In other words, you engage in these two activities, thinking about something, thinking of something first, and thinking about it. And then you break into speech without having had that verbal thought in the mind. There's no external verbal action. These are also two elements of the first jhana. Some people say there shouldn't be any thinking in jhana, and that when the Buddha's talking about vitakka, vijara in the context of jhana, he means something else. But if he had, he would have been a pretty bad teacher. If he uses his words in a special way, he takes pains to explain them. But here there's none of that. The image that's given for this is of the activity of a bathman. In those days, they didn't have soap. If you were going to take a bath, you needed a bathman to mix powder with water to make a kind of dough that you would rub over your body. This is the activity of vitakka vijara. As he said, in this case, it's taking a sense of pleasure you have in the body and learning to work it all the way through the body, thinking about it, where is it blocked, where is the pleasure to begin with, how do you maintain it, how do you work it through the body. And John Lee's explanation for this is to make use of the breath energy. And so you're thinking about the breath and you're evaluating the breath. Where is it comfortable, where is it not comfortable? If it's not comfortable, what can you do to change it? If it is comfortable, what can you do to maintain it? And then what do you do with that pleasure? How do you get it to spread through the body? You think of it going down the spine, out the legs, going down the center of the front of the body, going all throughout the head, down through the arms. Or sometimes you think of it coming up. If the back is feeling weak, think of the energy coming up the back instead of down. From the base of the feet, on up through the legs, up through the back. It's something you have to evaluate on your own, because you're trying to get the mind to stay together with the object. You're trying to get the breath to fill the body with that sense of pleasure to fill the body. And so getting the breath to fill the body is a very good way of doing that. And you want your awareness to fill the body as well. You want all three of these things to come together. This is why these three things, body, feeling, and mind, are the first three frames of reference when you're establishing mindfulness. You want everything to fit. And then you comment on it. That's what the evaluation basically is. You comment on it to yourself to see, is this going the way you want it? Is it not? Because you have to apply these fabrications, not only to the breath, but also to the mind. What is your mind doing right now? If it's slipping off, is the problem with the breath, or is the problem actually with the mind? Where is it going to feed? If you find the mind feeding on something that's not good, how do you bring it back to get it to feed on the breath? This is another activity of directed thought and evaluation. You want to get the mind snug with the object. Sometimes it means making it adjustments to the object, sometimes with the mind. It's like getting two pieces of wood to fit together snugly. Sometimes you have to sand this piece of wood, sometimes you have to chip a little something off of that piece of wood till finally they fit. And when they fit, you can put this thinking aside. But it's always there in the background. Because as the meditation goes, sometimes it swerves off the topic, and you want to be able to notice that. And you have to learn how to talk yourself back into coming back. This is also an activity of verbal fabrication. This is where the Buddha gets into what he calls the fabrications of exertion. Because some of the causes of suffering in the mind are things that all you have to do is look at them, and you see that they're really not worth going for. And they fall to the side. Other things, though, you can look at them, and they just look right back. That's a part of the mind that is resistant to letting go of certain things. And that's when you have to use even more directed thought and evaluation, bring in all the other fabrications, working with the breath, which is bodily fabrication, working with your perceptions, the images you hold in your mind, the ideas that sort of sit there as words or images. And you have to ask yourself, when the mind is going for something that's off target, how do you bring it back? Because some of the food that we feed on, it's easy to see that when you eat this kind of food, you get sick, and so you say, well, it's not really worth it, and you give it up. But other kinds, you don't. And maybe because the effects are going to take a long time to appear. Either that or you're so used to eating that particular food, and you eat it every day, so you don't see any connection between what you're feeling, how the mind is reacting to an object, and how it's connected to the way you're feeding on something. It's like sugar. People who eat sugar every day are pretty used to what it feels like to have sugar every day, and they take it as normal. And to realize that it's not normal, it doesn't have to be that way. You have to wean yourself off of the sugar. And that requires some thinking about long term. What are the long term results of feeding in this way? And you have to be willing to give it up. And the results of giving up at first may be unpleasant. But after a while, you get to the point where sugar smells bad. Then you realize, oh, it really is having a bad effect on the body. But you had to force yourself to get to that point. So in some cases, when you're doing direct thought and evaluation about something that you're obsessed with or something that you're holding on to, you have to think about long-term consequences and be willing to talk to yourself, to remind yourself every day, every time you feel tempted to follow that particular line of thought, it's the long-term consequences are bad. There's another kind of food, though, where you actually see the results, and you see that there's harm, but you don't care. Back when I was teaching at Chiang Mai University, there were a group of us who would get together once a week. We'd fan out through the city of Chiang Mai to get Northern Thai food. And we knew where the best barbecue chicken was, where the best nam prik ong, or all the other really good Northern Thai dishes. So we'd fan out and get all the best and bring it back to a spot and have a picnic, and everybody would get diarrhea the next day. And then the next week we'd do it again. And a lot of things that the mind focuses on and gets obsessed with are just like that. You see the consequences, but you don't care. So I'm much more attracted to the taste of Northern Thai food. I can put up with the diarrhea. That's what you think. And so this, in this case, you have to really think about the consequences. And see the fact that they really are harmful. That requires extra thinking. You realize you have to contemplate the allure that you get from the allure that you find, say, in Northern Thai food, and the consequences it's going to have for your body. Is the taste really worth it? And the part of the mind that says yes, you have to question that. Look around for other consequences that you may not be noticing. And to finally decide, yes, you do care. This is why the Buddha stresses heedfulness so much. You'll have to learn how to think heedfully. You don't want to expose yourself to dangers, because there are some kinds of diarrhea that, whatever it is, the germ in there can get into your liver and have long-term consequences. I remember meeting someone who'd been to Thailand before I went. He'd been with the Peace Corps. And he'd gotten some kind of intestinal bug that had plagued him for 5 years afterwards. And so to wean myself off of Northern Thai food, I had to think about that intestinal bug. You get to the point where you say, okay, it's not worth it. 5 years of bad health for just a fleeting taste. The other kinds of food where you can't even imagine not eating that food. This is where, again, where direct thought and evaluation come in, where you have to learn how to expand your imagination. Years back, there was that book, Material World, that came out. And one of the houses that they were analyzing was in Bhutan, this family that had a pit toilet right under the house. And of course, the flies in the pit toilet, it was an open pit toilet, would buzz up and get on the food that everybody was eating, and everybody had diarrhea every day. And they didn't imagine that there was any other way to live. It would have taken someone to come in and show them, okay, if you move the toilet away and you close it up, your health is going to improve. Sometimes when you find yourself obsessed with something, you have to ask yourself, is there some other way of thinking about this? Can you imagine another way of thinking about it? This is especially strong when we have very strong opinions about things, and we're sure that we're right about them. But then you have to ask yourself, okay, holding on to your rightness about that particular opinion, where does it get you? If it gets you upset, is it worth holding on to? If it gets you involved in arguments, is it worth holding on to? Sometimes yes, but a lot of times no. So you have to imagine what it would be like not to hold on to that. That's a story that a John Cha tells about the group of guys going through a forest, and they hear a rooster crow, and three of them put their heads together and say, let's say that's a chicken. See what the other guy says. The other guy says, no, of course it's a rooster. And they say, no, it's a chicken. They go back and forth, and the guy who's convinced that it's a rooster, and really he's really right, gets really upset about it. In this case, holding on to your rightness is actually a source of suffering. So in this case, you use your directed thought and evaluation to think about, why am I holding on to these things, and what are the consequences of it? This is especially important as you start meditating. You find that your increased powers of concentration and your greater time alone, you get obsessed with things. And you can be very right about them, and yet you suffer. So this is where you have to step back and ask yourself, okay, what is this activity that I'm doing? Where is this taking me? This is another function of the establishing of mindfulness, looking at the activities of the mind and ask yourself, where does this particular activity fit in that framework that the Buddha gives for dealing with skillful and unskillful thoughts? And unskillful doesn't necessarily mean wrong. You can be right about something, but you can hold on to your rightness unskillfully. You have to especially be aware when your increased powers of concentration get you more and more obsessed. So directed thought and evaluation really are thinking about things. It's not just a wobbling of the mind, as one teacher once said. And they have a real purpose in getting the mind into concentration and keeping it in concentration and taking it to higher levels of concentration and protecting the mind as it slips off and starts getting into what Ananda called, unskillful concentration, where you can be absorbed in the jhana of anger, absorbed in the jhana of lust, and absorbed in the jhana of fear. These are kind of jhana as well, but they're not the right path. So you have to learn to raise questions, i.e. evaluate what you're doing, what the results are, so you can peel yourself away from the causes of suffering that are especially attractive, the ones where you're right. But the rightness right there doesn't get you anywhere. When the Buddha is talking about right view, it's all about what you're doing that's causing suffering right now. As for the rightness of issues out in the world, those are put aside. What can you do to put an end to that suffering you're causing it yourself? That's what right view is all about. So everything gets brought back inside. Even though in the descriptions, the establishings of mindfulness, the Buddha sometimes talks about being aware of bodies outside or feelings outside or mind states outside. It's all meant to reflect back inside. You see other bodies dying, you realize, okay, that reflects back on you. I too am subject to dying. You see other people when they're greedy, when they're obsessed with fear, when they're angry. You reflect back on yourself. What am I like when I do those things? Do I look like that? You see how ugly it is in other people, how harmful it is. Well, learn to look at yourself. Bring everything back inside. In other words, meditation is not just about stopping thinking, but it first requires that you learn how to think properly, so you can get a good perspective on what you're doing that's causing your suffering and how you can put an end to it. That's when thinking is useful. And when it's brought you to a point where the mind and the body and the feelings of well-being all come together, fill the body, okay, then you can put the thinking aside. But be ready to pick it up when you need it again. This way it's an integral part of the path. And it brings all the elements of the path, mindfulness, concentration, right view, right resolve, brings them all together. So learn how to put your thinking into good use. before you think about letting it go.